So my topic tonight is perhaps unusual, but my topic is Zen and baseball. Baseball occupies a rather unique place in my memory because, for instance, I cannot remember the name of a single one of my elementary school teachers, but I can remember the flight of the ball as I hit my first home run in the fifth grade on the playground. I was in Little League, and I still have like a bodily memory of playing shortstop and having a line drive hit at me and leaping up and catching it. So these kinds of maybe it was the quality of unqualified success that made maybe I didn't see that so much. I couldn't see that so much as a kid, you know. Some kind of unqualified success. And so maybe that's why it sticks in my memory. And I was also a San Francisco Giants fan. I grew up in the Bay Area. So my childhood heroes were Willie Mays, Willie McCovey, and Orlando Cepeda. And old timers are nodding like they remember these names, but you have to be a bit of an old timer to remember these names and remember these names as, you know, living people who are playing, you know, at that time. And so again, I don't remember, I do remember a couple of names from junior high school, not of my teachers, but of fellow students. I don't remember any of the teachers' names, but I do remember listening to during the in 1962. I know this is long before many of you were born. In 1962, the Giants won the National League pennant, and at the penultimate game, they put the game on the loudspeakers in class. And everything stopped in the school, everything, all teaching, all instruction. And we listened to the Giants win the pennant in 1962. So that definitely sticks in my mind. But of course, you know, this is a Zen hall, and I'm not here to just, you know, glory in my memories of Little League success or you know, Major League Baseball, although I do still follow that a little bit. But what brought baseball to mind was something called the release point. And this is something that is kind of one of these inside baseball things. But it's a real thing, and what it is the point when a pitcher throws is in his delivery. They called it the delivery when he's in his arm motion or her arm motion. If it's a softball player these days, you see the women softball players, they're amazing. They do these underhanded pitches where they wind up and throw the ball underhand and. They throw it very fast and very hard. So in either case, the release point is the point where the pitcher lets go of the ball, that point. And that point, and knowing what that point is and controlling what that point is really important to pitchers. And it's really important to the success of their being able to, you know, induce a weak hit from the batter or strike them out. So somehow, this term came to me the other day, and I think it was kind of after getting up from Zazen and in my morning practice, and this words, the release point, came to mind. And I thought, the release point is something that Zen students want to become familiar with. You could say that this Zazen that we do, this sitting meditation that we do, is itself the release point. It is itself a release point. You could also say that the endeavor of the way is to sit at the release point, to find that point of release in your sitting. And of course, we're not talking about releasing some external object. We're talking about releasing you. We're talking about releasing your self-concern. And at the basic level, releasing, and traditionally, releasing your self-concerned thinking, which composes a lot of our thinking, and then releasing all kinds of afflictive emotions and thoughts and cognitive constructions, such as fear and anxiety, judgment of other people, all those emotions and cognitive constructions that keep us in their grip. They keep us in their grip. One thing that pitchers and Zen students have in common is that to be settled on their release point, to be settled in their practice, what their practice is. Obviously, a pitcher's is to pitch, but a Zen student's practice is to sit. To be settled in that point, they can't really think about that point. They can't really aim for that point. They can't really they can kind of make a concerted effort, but it can't be a grasping effort. It can't be looking for some particular thing. It could, of course, the pitcher wants to throw a strike, and we want to have a settled period of Zazen. We want to have a calm mind and body. So, those are sort of, this is the business, the pitcher's business is to throw a strike. Our business is to have a calm mind and body. But in both cases, this has to be found in the body. It has to come from the body, and we train our body and mind to encounter the release point without grasping the release point, without trying for the release point. So, so they have a word in baseball for what happens when a pitcher starts to think about their delivery. But starts to think about, when should I release the ball? When should I let it go? And in other words, the pitcher can become self-conscious. And the word for this is called the yips. And this is a dreaded term in baseball. And, if you knew a pitcher, you would never say this word around the pitcher. You would never want to put the thought in their mind that they could become self-conscious about their pitching. So there's actually a teaching about this idea of becoming self-conscious in our Zen practice that is kind of the yips of Zen. And its teaching is from Bodhidharma. Have people heard of Bodhidharma? Bodhidharma is the first Chinese Zen. He was an Indian person, or maybe an Afghan person, who immigrated to China. And, in our stories about Zen, we say that he's the ancestor that brought Zen to China. And he's kind of a semi-mythical type of person. But there are treatises attributed to him. And one of those treatises is called A Teaching on Pacifying the Mind. And it says in that treatise, "Why do people of the world fail to attain enlightenment in spite of all their studies, in spite of all their practice? They do not attain enlightenment because they are self-conscious. Fully developed people do not worry in miserable situations, and they do not rejoice in pleasant situations. This is because they are not self-conscious." So this is a teaching for us that Zazen is not to be thought of like, I'm sitting Zazen, and I am perfectly calm and contented. It's not quite it. We don't. It's not. In other words, it's not like a mantra or the power of positive thinking. It's not like that. It's not like that. It has to be. This self-consciousness is a barrier. That comes up when we're trying to find the release point, when we devoutly wish in our practice. It's okay to devoutly wish for the release point, I would say. I devoutly wish for the release point. I have encountered the release point before, and it's a great relief. It's a great relief to find the release point. So, it's not impossible to think about it, but to devoutly wish and care for the release point, but to become self-conscious about it, and, or even worse, go around telling people, "I found the release point today. It was wonderful. How about you?" And we don't do that. We keep this practice to ourselves in a certain way, kind of a secret. Like, sometimes it's tempting. It is sometimes tempting to come out and from your Zazen room and say something about your condition. But most of the time, one should resist that, I think. But anyway, back to baseball. A really good pitcher, and major league pitchers are all really good. It's just a very slight difference between them, but they don't get upset for the most part. It would be not part of their discipline to get upset when they throw a non-strike, which is called a ball. They don't get upset when part of their discipline is not to get upset when they throw a ball and not to get excited when they throw a strike, because their discipline is to stay within the process, and this is like us, not for us. You know, not to get upset when we spend a whole period of Zazen with our mind wandering and telling stories and going off in here and there, and not to get overly excited when everything is quite settled and peaceful. So we're like the pitcher in that way. I have a story that I like to tell. I don't know if I've told it here before, but I was once in a situation. I was at work in an office, and I had an enthusiastic friend in the office. And for some reason, he had a can of paint in the office. I can't remember why he had a can of paint, because this is a white collar type of office. You know, it wasn't the office of a shop or something like that. It was a white collar situation, and he had this can of paint, and he wanted to show it to me. And so he decided to open the can of paint right there in his cubicle. And what had happened is the paint, as paint sometimes does, separates into a very thin, liquidy part and a more viscous part. And of course, you have to stir it. Well, he opened the can of paint and jostled the can of paint a little bit. And all over the place went the liquidy part on his clothes, his work clothes, his nice work clothes, the desk, the floor. A lot of paint, a lot of liquidy paint went on the floor of the office. And one thing that, why I remember this is, I mean, that's kind of a startling thing in itself, but what really made it significant is he evinced no negative emotion whatsoever. He just started cleaning it up. It was seamless, and it was just seamless. He just opened the can of paint. The paint spilled. He started cleaning it up, and the quote said, "Fully developed people do not worry in miserable situations." And I, at that time, I thought, "This is a." I thought something like, I didn't have those exact words then, but I thought something like, "This is a really developed person." You know, I thought to myself, I would not have reacted that way. And to see somebody react that way, which was non-reaction, was really encouraging. Really, really encouraging. And I thought, you know, I want to be like that. I want to be just that way. Just, you know, miserable situations happen. And, you know, how do I want to be in those miserable situations? So back to baseball. In baseball and in other sports, you often hear people say, there's a pretty common expression, and the pretty common expression is, "I just let the game come to me." After the game, the guy who usually gets interviewed is the guy who did the best, right? And I just let the game come to me. I didn't try to do too much. This is a very common thing to hear. But these people who say this, they've just done really, really well. And they're kind of praising not that they went into something called the zone. They didn't have to try very hard. The game just seemed to flow toward them rather than them going toward the game, you know? So recently, you know, in baseball, there was this kid, just like, I don't know, 19 or 20 years old or something, and he came into a game, and he hit four home runs, and he hit six hits in the same game, and four of them were home runs. And, you know, that doesn't happen by virtue. I mean, it certainly happens by virtue of your skill, but it also, there's something else at work. You know, there's something else at work when the game is coming to that person, you know, at that time. There's something, there's some magic, it seems to me, that's that's happening. But, you know, for Zazen, we could also, you know, use these words, you know. I sit down and I let Zazen come to me. I just let, I don't try to do too much. As I said before, you know, we have an interest in the release point, and we are, you know, even devoted to the release point. But trying too hard, we're in danger of getting the yips, and we will lose our mindfulness in the midst of our trying too hard. But when we're just, you know, just making enough effort, just enough effort, not too little and not too much, and then we allow the, you know, Zazen to come to us. But if we practice self-consciously, this is called, in some of our literature, this is called the medicine becomes the disease. The medicine becomes the disease. In other words, our practice engaged in wrong-headedly, driven by some kind of desire or egoistic motivation, then becomes, even though it looks like practice, it's actually just part of the regular egoistic disease. So we have to be careful. So back to baseball. I made up a baseball koan. A pitcher asked his coach, "How can I find the release point?" The coach said, "If you try to find it, you lose it." The pitcher said, "What would be right then?" The coach said, "Let the body and arm motion lead the way. Don't think about it. Before you throw, the ball is already in the catcher's glove." Before you throw, the ball is already in the catcher's glove. It's not, you know, this is the independence. This is the independence of your effort and awakening. We say awakening cannot be defiled. It can't be defiled by your activity. So this is the good news. No matter how self-conscious and wrong-headed your effort is, you still can't defile awakening. Because awakening is just what's happening. But if you want to participate in awakening, keep your consciousness, keep your attention rooted in the body. That's what a pitcher does. If a pitcher thinks too much about what he's doing, he can't do it. It has to be in his body or her body. Just the release point found in the body. So, you know, in Zazen, we're not, you know, throwing a ball. We're actually throwing ourselves, you know. We're actually throwing ourselves into Buddha. We're throwing ourselves into Buddha. Or throwing ourselves into awakening, or in throwing ourselves into realization, becoming not different from realization, which we already are, but we just continue becoming. And anyway, when we're doing this practice of throwing ourselves into zazen, nevertheless, we do not throw a strike every time. We do not hit the mark every time. And Dogen, Master Dogen, says this about not hitting the mark. He says, after we arouse the body and mind, or the body-mind, and wholeheartedly practice the difficult practice, even though we practice, we cannot hit the mark once in 100 times. And yet, if we can hit the mark with our in our practice with our teachers and with scripture. I didn't read that right. And yet, we can hit the mark when we practice with our teachers and with scriptures. Hitting the mark at this present moment is enabled by the strength of 100 attempts which were off the mark. 100 practices which were off the mark enable us to become mature. 100 attempts that were off the mark enable us to become mature. So we, you know, moment after moment in zazen, period after period, day after day, we get another chance, you know. And so often we miss, but the missing, we miss it, you know, but the missing is as important as the perfect strike. Because it, for one thing, it chips away at our ego, right? It chips away at our ego. We're humbled, you know, by zazen many times over and over again, or by our failure, to accomplish the way in the way that we've heard it described of letting go into the ease and bliss of the present consciousness. So back to baseball. There's another thing that pitchers do that Zen students can learn from. This is a teaching of compassion. I think the way that's the way I've always interpreted it. One thing that when a pitcher strikes out a batter, either by a called strike or by throwing a strike and the batter swinging and missing. The batter is out on the third strike, and what many pitchers do, almost invariably they do, is they walk up off the mound, they pitch from a raised place, and they walk off the mound and they turn their back on the batter. They don't look back at the batter. So they have won, you know, they have won this battle, you know, this one on mano a mano battle with the batter by striking them out, but they don't want to lord it over. They don't want to lord it over that person who struck out. They know that it hurts to strike out. They know that that person is defeated and they have won, but they don't want to, you know, look at them and, you know, embarrass them further by in any way seeming to gloat or glory over the fact of having gotten the strikeout. So they walk off the mound and they turn their back and the batter is often look at the pitcher, but of course the pitcher is not looking at them, and it seems like this is kind of a kabuki thing, you know. This is the way it's done, you know. The batter gets a look, but he looks at the back of the pitcher, and the pitcher doesn't look back at the batter. So I thought, well, this is similar to an instruction that we give in beginning meditation, which is don't look back. And we often tell people who are beginning to sit, practice meditation, don't review. So you don't, in beginning practice and later practice, you don't review how you got off track. You get off track and you find that you are off track and your mind has wandered to today or tomorrow or yesterday, and you don't try to investigate where did that start. You just return right then, right at that moment that you wake up. You know, it's kind of a little waking up, right? Oh, I'm thinking. You know, I've dropped into thinking. There's always that little moment of oops. And so, but just at that moment, you just return to your mindfulness on the spot. On the spot was a word we heard this weekend. How did that line go? Anyway, you wake up on the spot, right now. We had a priest ordination here on Saturday, and then there was another one in Berkeley on Sunday. We had some of us went to two priest ordinations this weekend. But anyway, it has a line in there that something like, you know, receiving these vows, you wake up on the spot. So anyway, this is a good teaching too for our Zazen practice. Don't review, don't you know, just turn back from that activity of the self that started. Turn back from that. Turn back from that failure. Don't review. Just reestablish. You know, you check your posture. You know, am I sitting up straight? My shoulders relaxed. Okay, starting. Begin again. Begin again. So there's a student of Dogen's, Master Ajo, and he has a teaching about not looking back. So I'll end with this teaching. Ajo said, "People of the way, throw your body and mind into the great treasury of light." Great treasury of light is a very magnificent expression for Zazen. Okay, it's Zazen writ large. Throw body and mind into the great treasury of light without looking back. Sit grandly under the eaves. We have some eaves. Without seeking enlightenment, without trying to get rid of illusion, without aversion to the arising of thoughts, and yet without fondly continuing thoughts. If you do not continue thoughts, thoughts cannot arise by themselves. Like an empty space, like a mass of fire, letting your breathing flow naturally out and in. Sit decisively without getting involved in anything at all. So, this is how we play the game. And you know, we don't have any winners and losers, which is very different than baseball. Everybody's a winner, everybody's a loser. equal opportunity to lose and win in this practice. Thank you very much. I guess we have a few minutes if you want to make some questions or comments. Yes, Barry.
Thanks, Jim. That was a kind of a Dharma talk tailor-made for me. I love Zen and love the Giants. When you were talking about the not being self-conscious and just letting it kind of, I'm kind of paraphrasing, but kind of flow not self-consciously, it made me think of maybe I'd like to hear your opinion about this, is another similarity between baseball and Zen is a lot of baseball, they have a lot of rituals, right? Mm. And these rituals are designed to get them into the, you know, into the state of mind where, like, we come all bow to our cushion, or of course the services, or even like swinging after Zazen. Like for me, at least, those rituals are a reminder to be mindfulness and kind of let go of self-consciousness. And I'm curious if you think that that similarity exists as well.
Absolutely, yeah. Ritual in Zen practice, the space. I mean, baseball is played in a space. It's a certain configuration. It has a certain, dimensions and players, play definite positions. And we are very much organized. This is a very organized form of. I mean, this is not a Zen temple. If you walked into a Zen temple, you would see even more of a definite form of the whole space is a ritual space. The whole space is a ritual space, and it's been thought about for thousands of years now about how to make the space. The space, assists you. It aids you in entering it. It gives you, and when we first when we come in and we're set up, and in at least rows, we feel some that there's some formality, right? There's something formal about this. There's a certain way to enter. There's a certain way to bow to your cushion, a certain way to bow away and sit down and so forth. There's a lot of different forms of Zen practice, and those forms are really there to free us from, having to make, once we decide on our seat, I mean, that's you decide your seat. After that, everything is kind of prescribed. You don't have to think about which ways to move or how to act in any given moment during the ritual portion. Of course, and so I think ritual is not very. It's somewhat being lost in our modern world quite a bit. Ritual activities are not as nearly as common as they used to be. Maybe that is why people like some sport. Because it's kind of we know people are going to do certain things and they're going to act certain ways, and if they don't act those ways, they're going to get in trouble. And there's kind of some rules. And then once in a while somebody does something really unusual within the space and everybody wakes up. So, it's kind of like us.
Well, Willie McCovey hit the longest home run I ever saw. may have been 62, but maybe mid-60s in Cincinnati at Old Crosley Field. Behind the left field fence, there was a huge, tall chain link fence because there's a parking lot on the other side and to keep people's windshields from getting busted. And McCovey usually hit him to right field, but he hit that one over that huge chain link fence. I don't know if it's ever come down. But now back to Zen. You were talking about the player in the interview saying, I let the game come to me rather than the player going to the game. And that brought to mind Dogen's thing of being actualized by the myriad things, as opposed to oneself actualizing the things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That just
kind
of rang a bell with me or something.
That sounds like another intersection. Yeah. To study the Buddha way is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be actualized by the myriad things.
Thank you.
Yes. Baseball included. And, you know, bugs and flowers. Grizzly bears.
Thanks for the talk, Jim. I'm just wondering, can you extend your analogy? Is there a Zazen no-hitter?
There is a Zazen perfect game. And that's called Buddha. And after, you know, many lifetimes on the Bodhisattva path, and to be on the Bodhisattva path is to be becoming, always becoming Buddha, always moving and going in the direction of Buddha. So, you know, perfect game is when the pitcher faces only 27 batters. That's the minimum number of batters, and everyone is out. But this is like Buddha's perfect game is everyone is in. Everyone is included, and the whole stadium wakes up together.
Yeah, Jim, I hate to do this, but when you were talking about how the pitcher does not want to further embarrass the batter, it brought to mind an interview I heard with Raleigh Fingers years ago where he expressed his intense hatred for the opposing batter. And I guess it helped his performance, but it also brings to mind something that baseball has that Zen does not, is the competitive spirit of the game.
Yes. Right.
It seems to me that the biggest difference between a pitcher's release point and ours on the cushion is that when the pitcher releases the ball doesn't come back. And you talked about catching ourselves, you know, with the wandering mind and starting over. But I had a very funny image as you were saying that I guess you could do it with film of the pitcher. The ball leaves the hand and then rewind, right? The ball comes back.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what my meditation is like a lot, right? The ball never gets very far from the pitcher's mound. You might get a release point, and then it's back in your hand, which is why there's no score either on the cushion. You can't score. You could never score because the ball's always coming back.
Well, and there is no ball, though.
True enough. It just shows the limits of the metaphor. But I amused myself with this image of the ball suddenly flying at the pitcher and being back in her hand, you know, which is how I feel.
Yeah. Yeah, I've come
to a question on Zoom.
Oh, okay. Saved by the Zoom. Hi, Katie.
Hi, thank you so much for the talk, Jim. This sports analogy I find really helpful. I'm not good enough at baseball to know how that feels, but I have felt it in water skiing and gymnastics and swimming. And when we were kids in Michigan, we all grew up with water skiing in the lake, and my mom would get in the water with us and my cousins or friends or whoever. and just push us up, you know, 10 times, 20 times, however many times it took. And until you felt that balance point, you would just fall and fall and fall. And then once you felt that balance point, you could ski. And so that's what it reminded me of. And there were those 100 times of missing the mark beforehand. And it's not something you can think about or try. You just have to feel it in the body. And same with gymnastics, learning a new trick and just falling over and over again until finally you just feel somehow. And this also reminded me of a quote from Reverend Master Jiu. I guess she was known to say, I've heard this before, that if you're going to sit in front of a wall and practice meditation, you run the risk of being grabbed by the cosmic Buddha. And I just really like that. Like, you can't, you just put yourself there in the right circumstances. And this is a risk that we take. We can't just make it happen. And also the thing about if you're trying to go towards it, you're going away from it. I've heard in some of the Zen ancestors, or I can't remember exactly where I read different versions of that statement, but yeah, this was really helpful. The baseball simile was helpful for me, so thank you.
I think I stole. If you go towards it, you go away from it from the ordinary mind koan. It's getting late, but what is the Buddha way? The ordinary mind is the way. How do I get some of that? If you go toward it, you go away from it. If you try to grasp it, you lose it, or something like that. Yeah, so it's from that. It's pretty much lifted from that koan.